Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Chiller. Now, as you can probably already hear, I have a bit of a cold, or I'm getting over a cold, to be precise. So you'll have to put up with that sound in my voice. But anyway, I have an interesting show. I've got my links for you. And then I have an interview with Martin Mao of Chronosphere, ex-Uber, and other companies about their new, a big data streaming analytics platform built on the open source project M3. But that's coming up later. Let's start with my favorite links for the week. Beginning with an article from John Fingus on Engadget, always my favorite segment of the show. In fact, maybe I should actually just make a segment because it seems to be a topic that I bring up quite a lot. Old technology. It is a couple of days ago, it was the 25th anniversary of PlayStation, the original PlayStation. Obviously, PlayStation still exists, but this is the original one. That's actually also quite amazing if you think, I don't really keep up with consoles very much, but I guess they're still up to PlayStation 4. Maybe 5 is coming soon. That's 5 models in 25 years, one every 5 years, which is pretty slow pace of release, actually, which is also kind of interesting in its own right. But anyway, I digress. This is a post dissecting the original PlayStation. I acquired one at one point, actually. And I guess the first thing that strikes you in the photo is how big it all is. You know, there's a lot of surface mount technology in devices these days. It's got a CD drive, which I don't think you have anymore in modern consoles. Again, I'm not so sure. It's got huge resistors and capacitors and just a lot of space. I mean, I don't know if you would want to service a PlayStation, but I guess you could. And that's something that's harder to do these days with any modern device, really. If you remember the PlayStation, I do. It was pretty amazing and groundbreaking at the time. And now I could probably emulate it on my iPhone quite easily, I guess. Well, I don't have an iPhone, but you know what I mean. And it'll look a lot better. But it was groundbreaking at the time. And have a little trip down memory lane and have a look inside, literally, the PlayStation, if you so desire. Next, an article on Gen from Medium by Maya Kosoff. This is the story of Big Calculator, how Texas Instruments monopolized math class, or maths class, however you prefer to say that. I found this interesting. I guess when I read this, I thought this was going to be historical and it would fit into my historical corner. But no. Texas Instruments graphing calculators is, I think I had one when I studied maths. I can't quite remember. I actually stopped studying maths fairly early on, so I don't entirely remember if I had one or not. Or maybe my dad had one, but that was quite some time ago. I guess I just assumed that things like graphing calculators had been replaced by apps. And yes, actually, they have. But, of course, if you allow children to use phones and tablets, then there's all sorts of other distractions. So calculators, graphing calculators, are still mostly preferred in many schools, especially in America, I guess, where this article is based. I don't know about the rest of the world. But despite them being pretty old technology, they haven't really changed very much in quite some time, in definitely the lifespan of some of the children that are using them. They're very expensive. And if you lose one, you have to get a new one. And in certain schools, in certain regions, kids just can't afford them. So the schools, or quite often, which is even crazier, the teachers have to buy them for their students so they can do the work. I mean, we're talking about very complicated maths here that you can't do in your head or on a normal calculator. Obviously, you could on a computer, but then, I don't know. I feel like there's better solutions to this than having a one-use, very expensive device and maybe locked down devices, Chromebooks or something like that, that you could just restrict access to, I feel like is a better option. But sometimes inertia and lethargy just take hold in these sorts of situations. But if you're fascinated to hear how, you know, a 20-something-year-old device is still a common requirement, well, I mean, of course, there's pencils and pens and things like that. But anyway, a technology device, well, that's also pens and pencils. Anyway, I digress. I think you get my point, even if I'm not making it very well. If you're fascinated to hear how such an old and unchanging device is still being used by children today, and possibly many of you who are parents also used it, then read on. It's fairly long. It's amazing to think that it's possible to write so much about the Texas Instruments calculator. But it is, and it's quite interesting. So enjoy. Now, this is not a new post. It's another Medium post from Woot. I'm guessing he's Dutch. about switching from macOS to Linux, and there's many posts like this. But I bring it up because I have been experimenting with this again. One of the people I work for, I discovered I was entitled to a work laptop. So I thought, here's a good opportunity to try Linux again. After hearing so many people say to me, oh, Linux just works now. Desktop Linux is much better than it used to be. You could do video editing. Many of the things that were on my checklist of necessities to switch from macOS that always held me back on Linux, people said, oh, it's better now. It's better. And after reading a couple of articles like this, it's become the kind of new cool thing to do, switch from macOS to Linux for certain sections of the computer-using population. I thought I'd give it another try. I'm not going to go into very much detail here because I've actually written quite a long article, which I will publish on DZone very soon. I have a few extra things to add to it from the past couple of days, which will detail my experiences. Shall we say, I'll give you a little hint that it wasn't all smooth sailing. But I think I'm going to leave it there. Maybe I'll save a further discussion for next week. But if you want to do some preliminary reading around the subject, then have a read of this post. And he has a couple of follow-up posts as well. I especially found the section on alternative software quite useful. Although, interestingly, a lot of the software is not necessarily fully open source, which I found interesting. The concept of having proprietary software in Linux has always been a strange one to me. It's fine, but it feels like the section of people who would want to use that would be small. Would it make it worth it? But anyway, that's for a bigger discussion. But yeah, have a read of this, and then I'll be back with my take next week or in the next couple of weeks, and you can hear about my experiences directly. On the subject of change and switching platforms, Tim Berners-Lee is back. He never really went away, but he's back with a new campaign, his global plan to save the web. This is his contract for the web. It's actually been announced over the past few weeks, where he's trying to encourage digital players to turn the web back to, I guess, what he always wanted it to be. Although, interestingly, a little bit of history here that not many people are necessarily aware of. I recently just finished reading The Innovators by Walter Isaacson, a very good book, actually. I really enjoyed it. I kind of could stop reading it. And in the section that covers Tim Berners-Lee and the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee was actually generally in favor of keeping the web fairly restrictive and to academics. So it's interesting that he now, people change, it's fine. He now kind of flies this flag for openness when actually it wasn't necessarily what he intended. And the browser manufacturers from the time, like Mosaic, for example, were actually the people who pushed him and the World Wide Web into being more open. But anyway, that was then, this is now. And I'm gonna phrase this. The contract for the web requires endorsing governments, companies, and individuals to make concrete commitments to protect the web from abuse and ensure it benefits humanity. This is all very noble, but what does it mean? And some of the people who have signed up for it are some of the companies that you could accuse of breaking it in the first place. So I'm not 100% sure what this is all really going to mean. I have been trying to line up an interview, actually, with Tim Berners-Lee for some time, since Web Summit a couple of years ago. I don't know if it'll ever happen, but I will keep trying, and maybe we can dig into some more details. But in the meantime, have a read of this article on The Guardian, and have a dig around the contract for the web website. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. What is it? Is it binding? Is it just grandiose statements? What do you think? You can let me know at christianschiller.com/contact. And another article on redesigning things that have not changed in a long time. This is from CNN, from Jacopo Prisco. And it covers, redesigning air conditioners. Air conditioners have not changed in a very long time. If the world is going to get hotter, we might need them. But ironically, they are often the cause of a lot of climate change. There's actually a statistic here. Let me just find it. 10%, which is fairly high. It's not the highest, but it's fairly high. And if you consider that not all the world really uses air conditioning, then that starts to show it would probably be a lot higher in certain countries. So how do we make it more efficient if we're going to need it? Now, recently, there is a new coalition from the Indian government, a place that definitely needs it, and the Rocky Mountains Institute. Rocky Mountains does not sound like a place that needs air conditioning, but still. They are offering a 1 million competition to improve air conditioning, and this article details some of the projects. And I am super fascinated to see how this goes. I have often looked at air conditioning and thought, how can we make this better? we all know it's terrible for the environment and very expensive. And it blows grids. When we lived in Melbourne in summer, often peak summer when there's lots of air conditioning, you have brownouts, the power would go out all the time. So it's actually a big problem in many, many ways. So I look forward to seeing the results of this and maybe in the near future, even sort of speaking to some of the people behind some of the projects and seeing what they've come up with and how long it will take for them to become commercially viable and on the streets, in our houses, and keeping us cool whilst the world is hot, but not heating the world up even more. And finally, very sad, little Bub, the little kitty with the sticky out tongue that made everybody very happy, has died. She's only 8, but I think she had health issues, so I guess that explains a lot. Very sad. Internet memes everywhere cried out. And the interesting thing here is a lot of the famous meme cats are all dead now. Keyboard Cat is dead. Grumpy Cat, I think, is dead. Little Bub is dead. They're about the only internet cats I really know, I think. But anyway, they're all gone. So who will replace them? We will see. Maybe it could be our cat. Could be onto a fortune there. Anyway, spare a thought for Little Bub and his little face. Not her little face, sorry. It doesn't sound like a female name, does it? But anyway, so shed a tear, stick out your tongue for 1 minute silence. I hope you enjoyed my links this week. And now I have an interview with Martin Mao of Chronosphere. Enjoy.
So our journey began at Uber 4 years ago. And what we realized at Uber, as we were going through the migration in adopting Kubernetes and a cloud native architecture, so adopting like microservices and running everything on containers, we realized that none of the tooling that existed there could handle the sheer volume of monitoring data being produced. So none of the tooling could even store all of the data being produced, let alone sort of do anything useful with it. And as we were going through this with Uber, we sort of looked around the market, couldn't find anything, and we ended up building our own solution, which we actually built in open source. And that solution is called M3. And during our time at Uber, we actually managed to scale M3 up to one of the largest monitoring systems in the world today. And then earlier this year, we have decided to leave Uber and build Chronosphere, the company around the open source M3 technology, to sort of bring all the benefits that we sort of extracted with M3 and bring that to sort of enterprises all around the world.
Mm. So, I mean, there's a lot of monitoring stacks out there that claim to be able to do the same thing. So what's the problems they have, or what's the limits they have?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there are definitely a lot of monitoring solutions out there that claim that they are enterprise grade. But when you look into it, it's generally a few things that they fall short at. The first is the scale and the amount of data that they can store. If you look at a lot of these solutions that are enterprise grade, they store tens of millions of metric time series. And what we found is, you know, as you get more complex technology stacks and as you sort of move to Kubernetes, what ends up happening is you just generate a lot more time series than you used to. And, you know, if you look at something like M3, it can actually store tens of billions of time series. So it's actually not even just an order of magnitude, but it's multiple orders of magnitude more in storage, which is great. And then the two other things that really did differentiate it is with a scalable solution, that's really nice, but it needs to scale in a cost efficient way. So it can't just scale in a linear fashion in terms of cost, but we really made sure that as we scaled up the system in terms of storage, we scaled up the cost sublinearly. So you're not paying as much for the same amount of storage. And then finally, the big differentiator for enterprise is reliability. Mm. So if you look at a lot of these other sort of solutions that are out there, they run on a single region in a single cloud provider. And because of that, they can't really provide high levels of reliability. And that's one thing that sort of plagued our system at Uber many years ago. So what we ended up building, especially with Chronosphere, is a solution that runs across multiple regions in multiple cloud providers so that you get the highest level of reliability for your monitoring.
Would it be fair to say that you're starting to get into maybe the levels of technology and infrastructure that many might reserve for their main application more than just their monitoring stacks?
For sure, for sure. So yeah, I think if you look at what we used the underlying technology for and what a lot of companies use it for today, they're monitoring not just all of their infrastructure and their applications, but they actually quickly use the tool to monitor their business as well. So the use cases definitely sort of expand across a whole business.
Okay. So let's get into M3 first and kind of go up the layers. I mean, I guess it's open source, so we can go into some detail. What did you do to make it so much more optimized for this large scale use case?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when we first designed the first monitoring solution at Uber, before M3, we sort of used off-the-shelf open source technology for both our storage and our metric index as well. So we're using technologies like Cassandra and Elasticsearch. And what we found is that those technologies are just not purely tailor-made for the time series use case, right? Cassandra is a key value store and Elasticsearch is like a search engine. But what we ended up doing is beyond a certain level of scale, and when you need a certain level of performance and cost efficiency, you really need to build everything from scratch. So the first thing we did with M3 was to build a completely new time series database as our underlying storage engine. And that is built completely from scratch. It's not built on top of any other sort of existing storage technology. And then on top of that, we sort of then layer on an ingestion pipeline that's highly reliable and can do things like metric aggregation in a streaming fashion. And then also a scalable query engine as well, because, you know, storing billions of time series is great. But once you have it stored, you want to be able to query billions of time series. So all of those pieces of technology, we just found that at the scale that we were operating at and the performance that we required, nothing out there really solved that solution. So we really had to build everything custom from the ground up for this one particular use case.
Mm. And as far as I can tell, you just focus on the ingestion and the storage and kind of hand off the other stuff to other applications like Prometheus, for example.
That's sort of correct. Okay. It does the ingestion, the storage, and the query engine for sure. We, in the open source solution, we actually don't provide any of the visualizations or the alerting or the tooling there. In terms of Prometheus, we do plug and play with Prometheus. So people who are running Prometheus today, because, you know, Prometheus is great and it's the thing that everyone gets started with, but it doesn't solve, it runs on a single binary. So it doesn't really solve the scalable, high reliability in nature of your monitoring solution. So M3 in open source actually plays really nicely with Prometheus in the sense that it's the long-term storage for your Prometheus endpoints, which is great. But yes, in open source, you definitely have to sort of piece it together. And that's what we're doing differently with Chronosphere, is that we didn't just want people to have to piece things together. We wanted to both host everything for everybody so that we could run the complex M3 stack, but also provide the visualizations and the alerting tooling and the analytics tooling on top in an all-in-one product.
Okay. And how long did it take you to build? I mean, I've known some companies that have been trying to build something like this for years.
It definitely took us years to build. Okay, so we started the project in open source April 2016, and we're still actively chipping away at in open source and adding features every day. So it took more than 3.5 years to get to where it is today. And that was developed by a team of 20 senior engineers. Heavy investment in the project.
Okay. So let's move up the stack to Chronosphere. What is Chronosphere beyond, I'm guessing, M3 as a service? Like, I'm guessing you add more than that. So what do you add on top?
For sure. So what Chronosphere does is, first, it starts with M3, and actually we add a whole bunch of proprietary features that are not there. And all of these features are tailored around the enterprise use case. So with open source M3, you can actually scale a single deployment of that up to billions of time series. That is possible. But when you look at an enterprise, what you really want is sort of multi-tenancy controls that sort of map to your organizational structure. So you want teams to be able to sort of emit metrics that other teams cannot see. You want teams to have sort of resource allocation so that one does not step on the toes of another team and take the whole system down. And you also sort of want security and access controls as well. So all of those type of features are just not bundled with the open source M3 solution today. And that's the first thing that we layer on top of that with Chronosphere. And then the layer above that is what I mentioned earlier with the visualizations, the alerting engine, and the analytics tooling. So tooling that let you leverage the amount of data that you're storing now, all of that is also not available in the open source M3 solution. You sort of have to piece that together yourself. So that is something we provide. And then finally, we run the whole thing. We manage the whole thing. But we run that across multiple cloud providers for you so that, you know, you get the highest level of reliability without having to worry about how you're going to sort of structure that and take care of all of the underlying infrastructure for that.
And I mean, when we met Anish very briefly at Velocity, one of your colleagues started to show me a visualization. As much as is possible with no visuals, could you maybe just talk through how that works and what those visualizations would be useful for in comparison to, I guess, other types of visualizations that other people might have used?
Yeah, for sure. So first and foremost, we provide sort of, you know, the bare bone essentials of a monitoring system where you can sort of create dashboards and graphs and start graphing your metric and your time series data. And then we have an alerting engine that lets you set threshold-based alerts on top of that data so you can be notified. And that alerting engine sort of, you know, ties into the standard notification engines like PagerDuty and can send emails and things like that. So that's the sort of basic solution that we have and that people can do. But what we realized throughout time at Uber is that the amount of data actually grows at a much faster pace than the amount of engineers you hire to use this tooling. So what we ended up having to do is to automate a lot of that. So if you look at our platform today, while you can create custom dashboards, what happens is when you deploy our agent and our agent runs on Kubernetes as a daemon set, so there's like a one-click deployment, it automatically discovers all the metric endpoints to scrape and ingest metrics from. And then once it's starting to ingest them, it actually automatically recognizes a lot of those metrics because a lot of the systems you're monitoring are very well known. So if you're monitoring like an Elasticsearch cluster or a MySQL instance, it's actually fairly well known what those metrics are going to look like already. And then based on that, we actually go and generate you all of your dashboards for those pieces of technology automatically, and also the alerts for those as well. So, you know, as soon as you log into the system, once you've deployed the agent, you have a lot of your dashboards pre-generated and ready to go. So you don't have to configure anything manually. So you sort of get monitoring out of the box for free. And then the final thing on top of that is with the alerting engine, we also have anomaly detection running in the background. Because the thing is, it's actually also, it's not just quite hard to define what your alert should be. It's actually very hard to define what the threshold should be because that threshold changes over time depending on the load of your system, depending on the time of day, depending on, you know, the time of year. You know, like for Black Friday, for a lot of e-commerce stores, they get a lot more traffic than they would on a normal day. So what our anomaly detection sort of system does is automatically generate the alert thresholds for you based on week-on-week or year-on-year analysis. So it can sort of predict what sort of expected traffic loads are like, and it will set the thresholds accordingly to that. So the whole system is sort of, while it provides the basic building blocks that you could do everything custom yourself, what we really want to do is to automate as much of that as possible and just get you a working experience straight out of the box.
And I'm guessing with that automation you mentioned that sometimes teams are discovering metric endpoints that maybe they didn't even realize were there.
For sure. Yeah, no, that definitely happens a lot. And, you know, we definitely give controls to teams such that, you know, not only can they control which sources they want to ingest the metrics from, but also for each individual source, they can actually control both the retention period and the resolution. So you can imagine that, you know, a team has expose some metrics that are heavily used for debugging, and you might not want to keep those around for years because you're going to be paying expensive storage costs for those. So we actually give a lot of controls on defining not only what gets ingested, but at what sort of level of detail do they get ingested and for how long you want to retain that data for as well.
So let's actually go to some of the business side a little bit. The company, as far as I can tell, has not existed for very long.
Yes.
And yet you managed to raise 11 million Series A, which is a fair bit for especially for a tech focused company. Whilst I'm not going to ask you like how, because firstly, it's not really what I talk about, and secondly, you probably don't want to tell me. But I guess to raise that sort of fund so early, I'm guessing. I mean, first, the technology is proven. You've sort of already used it in a very large, well-known company. But what were some of the use cases that the funders saw would be very valid for particular businesses, especially that made them kind of invest such a large sum at such an early stage?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So as you said, you know, we had a sort of a boosted start where we already built this, the core underlying storage engine and everything in open source. So we could sort of build a business on top of that. So it was much faster for us to sort of get to market with an end-to-end product than if we had to build the whole thing from scratch. But a lot of the investors, when we started talking, I think they came to the realization that this migration to Kubernetes and cloud native is well underway for enterprises. And they came to the realization that a lot of the existing tooling out there today isn't really built for this sort of new generation of use cases. And, you know, talking to a lot of the existing customers of these other solutions, they hear the pain points, and those are the exact pain points that we are sort of trying to tackle, which is, you know, a lot of these solutions are very expensive as you get to large scale, and they're highly unreliable. So those are the sort of exact things that we are aiming towards. And those are the sort of design principles that we had when we built M3 from the beginning. So there was definitely a lot of alignment there. And I feel like the size of the funding was also because we're just much closer to getting a product to market. So it was less about building the product and finding the fit. We actually had a large pool of open source users even of our solution out there in the world that wanted a little bit more than what we just had in open source. So it was less of a exploratory phase for us and more of a execution and just getting the product out to market. And I think that was the reasoning behind the large round of funding.
And without divulging who you may or may not be speaking to, what are some of the common use cases or business sectors so far that have shown interest?
Yeah, I've actually tried to do the analysis to see if there's a particular sector or segment that you know heavily rely on this. And actually, it turns out it's quite spread across all the sectors. So, you know, without going to sort of particular names, we see, you know, companies in the finance sector. We see companies in e-commerce. We see companies in more traditional retail. We see companies definitely heavily in the tech sector as well. So it's actually like a monitoring, and because what you can use the underlying solution for, which is not just monitoring your infrastructure and your applications. And, you know, if you look at a lot of businesses these days, there's definitely a huge portion of technology, and they, you know, that is a huge part of most enterprises these days. But outside of monitoring that, you can also use the tool to monitor your business, right? So Uber was using it to actually monitor all of their products across all of their cities. And that would actually go and notify, you know, operations people, not just engineers, but operations people on the ground to let them know when something is wrong with a particular product in a particular city. So I think if you look at those use cases, that can be reapplied across pretty much all segments of the market. And that's what we're really finding with at least our open source tooling and also our paid product as well, is that we sort of get companies from all walks of life leveraging this technology.
Can you dig into a little bit more about what you mean by monitor your business? Do you mean from an operations side?
Yeah.
Or, okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah. Great question. It's mostly heavily on the operations side. We purposely do not, because it's still an engineering tool.
Yeah.
So, you know, we purposely tell companies to not rely on it for, you know, strict accounting purposes and whatnot, although you can definitely use it to get a real-time snapshot view of things like that. And that was definitely a previous use case and a current use case. But we just sort of tell companies to use it as a real-time monitoring and a real-time signal of things, as opposed to like the source of truth for their, you know, the actual revenue or, you know, sort of financial based use cases.
Mm-hmm. And I guess across M3 and Chronosphere, bearing in mind Chronosphere is pretty new, what's the sort of rough, it's always hard to tell with open source projects, but what would you say the kind of rough installation base is at the moment?
Yeah, great question. So installation base, we actually don't have exact numbers on that. We don't have like a phone home feature or anything like that. But I think if you look at, you know, we're gauging based off things like GitHub stars, is like more than 2,400 of those. And I think just based on the sort of community meetings we have, there's definitely, I would say, hundreds of customers or like hundreds of sorry, not hundreds of customers, hundreds of open source users out there of the technology. But I think if you look at something like M3, it's going to be less pervasive than something like Prometheus because it's not the tool that you start off with, right? It's the tool that you need once you get beyond a certain level of scale. And I think, you know, in that particular segment of the market, there's definitely a lot higher pervasive use than across the broader sort of SMB market per se. So, you know, so, some stats that we know we have, it's running in production today in like 15 of the Forbes 2000, for example, that we know of. And then, you know, if you go onto the GitHub page and look at some of the stargazers, I guess, the people who have started the project, you'll see that a lot of the companies that they work at are these large enterprises for sure. But we don't have exact validation on the exact number of installs because we don't really do a phone home feature or anything like that. We don't really like open source technology does things like that. And then in terms of the paid product, you know, we're in private beta right now, and we are onboarding a handful. We've already onboarded a handful of these customers, and we'll be looking to sort of expand that at a much more aggressive rate early next year.
It's actually a little bit of a tangential question, but I was just clicking around the M3 Getting Started guides and came across so aside from Judge is a small part of what I do because tech journalism is, you know, it's not the most, it's fun, but it's not necessarily the most lucrative of jobs. I actually mostly do a lot of technical documentation work. And I just came across a post in your own, in the M3 docs, not written by you, written by someone from Uber Open Source by the looks of it, which I've never seen before in an open source project, on tips for writing documentation. And actually a lot of them I would echo, 16 tips that, I mean, I'm not saying you have kind of any input or opinion on this, but is sort of usability and understandability of software always something that's been important to you and the co-founder and I guess other people involved with the project?
For sure, for sure. And in fact, if you look at the documentation, I mean, we have documentation there, but we actually don't love it as much. We don't think it is quite a level it definitely needs to get to. So I think there's been a couple of reasons for that. While we were inside Uber, we were sort of mostly focused on building the thing. And while we had a lot of outside interest, it's been much easier for us to sort of hold community meetings and like talk to companies face to face just because the underlying pieces as we were building in the years past were changing so quickly that the documentation would be outdated very quickly. So people would go read documentation that's not really reflective of the state of the world, I guess. Now that we're part of Chronosphere, we definitely want to invest heavily in, you know, our team inside Uber didn't really have a dedicated dev advocate writing documentation or anything like that. So, you know, now that we have found a Chronosphere, we've actually just hired our first dev advocates because we definitely want to put a lot more effort into documentation and supporting the community for sure.
Good to hear.
The documentation is a bit raw because I think also with something like this, again, it's not something like Prometheus where you can sort of pick it up and get started. Yeah. There's like large complex distributed systems you're running. So we sort of assume an underlying level of knowledge.
That's a whole other conversation around that kind of thing. But yeah. All right. Let's wrap up with obviously things are pretty new, pretty fresh. So I guess everything is in flux and in plan. But sort of most significantly, what's on the roadmap for the next 6 months or so?
Yeah, great question. So I think for the next 6 months, you know, there's some features we want to build back into the open source M3 community. So, you know, even though we have the paid product with Chronosphere and that's part of our concentration, we definitely want to upstream a lot of changes back into open source M3. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a lot of performance and sort of additional reliability and like things like backup and features like that we want to push back upstream for the larger community. And then in terms of Chronosphere, we're sort of looking at Chronosphere as, you know, a tool that you want to use to solve a particular use case. And this use case is to get alerted when something goes wrong and sort of get to a point where you can figure out the root cause and remediate the issue. So if you look at our roadmap there, you know, we've just added tracing integration mm-hmm. as a feature to our product a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it's not like we are trying to sort of be a one-stop shop for observability and offer like an end-to-end tracing product. But where we see tracing come in is, you know, once you do get alerted based on your metrics, you want to find additional details and context on what's going on. And that's what tracing is great for. So we sort of added that integration in a way that it's deeply integrated. So you use the same client to emit both your metrics and your traces mm-hmm. through OpenTelemetry. And then that's actually stored and deeply linked in the dashboard. So you can go straight from a metric data point to one of the traces that underpin that data point. So I think if you look at our roadmap, we're going to continue go down this path of like, what else can we do to optimize that particular use case of you want to set up some monitoring, get alerted and remediate your issue as soon as possible. Mm. So that's what's driving a lot of the feature development for our hosted product. And then, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, we're sort of upstreaming a lot of changes back into the open source community as well.
And I mean, we're getting to the end of the year now. You've just come out of Thanksgiving and stuff like that too. But are there any events on the horizon or even local meetups and stuff where people can come and take a look at what you're doing?
Yeah, great question. So we've actually, I think the sort of conference season has just ended. Because it was quite busy. But yeah, we started looking at our conference schedule for next year already, and we've identified quite a few. So in Q1, you know, we will be attending FOSDEM Europe, brilliant. Which yep. we love. It's an open source.
Yeah, no, I should be there. I pretty much go every year. So yeah. Cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I actually really like yeah. that. And, you know, there's no like, you know, we're not going to get a booth there or anything like that. But we'll try to get a talk and just have a meetup for people using M3 and whatnot. So that's one we love every year. We will be doing KubeCon EU towards the end of Q1 next year. And then we're also going to be partaking in DevOps days as well, because mm-hmm. those look like much more city local type of meetups. So we'll definitely probably be looking to do the one in New York, which is in Q1. And then also I believe they are in Seattle later in the year as well. So where we have engineers and, you know, we have 4 offices spread around the world. So wherever we have engineers, we'll be sort of trying to partake in those and some local meetups and whatnot as well.
That was my interview with Martin Mao of Chronosphere. Hope you enjoyed that. Next week is my final event for the year. I'll be at DevRelCon in London. If you are in that part of the world, come say hi. I'd love to meet you. And then I'm taking a bit of a break until the new year when I think I'm going to be at CES and South by Southwest. So big trips coming up. Actually, it's not very long away. It's only next month, isn't it? But anyway, it's next year. It always seems like such a long time away. In the meantime, you can find some of my writing on christianschiller.com/writing and more things there. I am going to be releasing a few new things over the Christmas break for you to enjoy, actually. I've got some new articles in progress that are nearly done as well, so more there. And write-ups from the various conferences I have been at the past few weeks, which were data natives. I actually had some quite interesting stuff there. I need to sort of digest it all and summarize it. I'm hoping to actually do an interview with the conference's founder too. I did a workshop on removing bias from artificial intelligence and machine learning data sets, which is super fascinating, which I will get into more soon as well. And then I went to 5G Checkery. Again, we learned more about 5G stuff. Then I got kind of sick, so it was a bit muted, but I have some interviews and things from there to get out to you as well. So more to come in the next few weeks before the end of the year. If you have enjoyed the show, please rate, review, share. I'd love to hear from you. And until next time, thank you very much for listening.